Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. It's Labor Day, and we take things literally around here. We are laboring on this Monday, this September 2nd, ready to go for a great final month of the fantasy baseball season. And today we have a very special guest. We've had a couple of repeat appearances on this podcast. They've always been Yahoo people. I think Behrens and Zinke and Del Don have all made multiple appearances. They've been terrific, and they're great. But this is the first time we're going to have a repeat guest who's outside of the Yahoo umbrella, and we're going to have him on for a couple of reasons. One is the first time we had Paul Sporer on. He was just fantastic. As you guys know, he's all over the place. He's written for 8 million websites, Fangraphs just being one of them. But, I mean, we could spend 20 minutes listing the work he's done. He was really terrific on the first pod, and I thought, we got to get this guy back. But then you need some basic rules of life, and I have a rule of life that when Justin Verlander throws a no-hitter, you got to get Paul Sporer on the horn. You got to get him engaged because, you know, he's a longtime Tigers fan. I grew up originally in Michigan, and he knows Verlander and follows him pitch for pitch as closely as anybody. So we're certainly going to talk some Verlander today. We're going to talk a lot of pitching, and then we'll get to our draft, which I don't think is going to reflect that well on Paul or myself. We're going to draft movies that we haven't seen, prominent movies that we haven't seen. That's for the later part of the podcast. Let me first say good morning to Paul Sporer and happy Verlander Day.
Morning, Scott. Thank you so much. We're gonna get some enemies here. We're gonna have some folks, or maybe not enemies, but just throwing up their hands, like, "Are you guys kidding me that you haven't seen X, Y, and Z?" And so it's perfect timing too. I kind of briefed you yesterday. I got a little story to go with the draft, and loved watching Verlander there. It's funny. He's thrown three no hitters, and I've not been home at my hub, you know, watching baseball for any of them. One, I was on a date with a girl, and I knew that relationship was doomed, his very first one. The second, I was at my sister's, the first one against Toronto. My sister's had like a barbecue, and I'm the guy in the office on the phone, you know, watching it while everyone else is downstairs enjoying drinks and burgers. And then yesterday, I was bowling with my girlfriend for half of it, but then we watched the final half. So I did get a chance to at least watch him clinch it. But yeah, for some reason, Verlander's chances of throwing a no-hitter are better when I'm nowhere near my my office and TV and everything.
Verlander now up to three no-hitters. And, of course, he's had some classic near misses. I remember really well a game against the Pirates where I think he was two outs away. And the whole game, I thought he's going to do it. And they got him at the last second. We were talking right before we hit record on this. One thing that really puts in perspective how amazing three no-hitters is there are some incredible pitchers who never did it. Roger Clemens, who his fingerprints are all over the record book, who was so great for so long, all those Cy Youngs and whatever you think of Clemens. I mean, the guy was an unbelievable pitcher. Pedro Martinez, who still might have the best peak of any pitcher I've ever seen, never threw a no-hitter. I mean, there are a bunch of guys. There are teams that have never thrown no-hitters. Now Verlander's at three. And then you see some guys who have two. Like, you know, how does Homer Bailey have two
no-hitters? Homer Bailey, yes.
Good pitcher, right? But, you know, how does he have two? Who was the soft-tossing lefty for the Burley? Did he throw two no-hitters?
I think yes, and the perfect game being
the
one
perfect
them,
game,
yes.
And Wise made that incredible catch. And it also was kind of cool about Sunday's game, which I only saw the late stages of it. I was actually going doing my Sunday thing. I was getting something to eat. I went to the driving range. You know, Sundays is always an errand day for me. But the great thing about today with media is that I found out on Twitter that he was deep into the game without the hit. Of course, they didn't have any runs yet. But yeah. I was able to dial up the app on my phone and watch the last couple of innings. And it's really cool that of all the star-studded people on this Houston roster who could have aided Verlander and gotten him the runs he needed in the ninth inning, it was like one of the most anonymous players on the roster who actually helped him out.
It was Abraham Toro, who not only is a pretty much, as you mentioned, nondescript rookie. He has some prospect pedigree, but nothing that's, you know, even on a par of like a Kyle Tucker who can't seem to find his way onto this team. But also, he's Canadian. So there was a little added bonus there since it was in Toronto that sure. Toro himself is Canadian, hits the two-run homer and assists the final out. It would have been interesting, right, if it goes nine deep and it's still 0-0. I think Verlander comes out for the 10th. I don't think there's any chance that Hinch is able to take him out, not without a fight, perhaps a literal fist fight, because it was looking like Verlander could have gone 12 yesterday. He was just dialed in, easy heat, nasty breakers. Yes, his pitch count was up there a bit, but that's one of the things about pitch counts and how they're not all created equally, because there was no stress in what Verlander was doing. So even a gaudy number like 140, something crazy like that, wouldn't have looked out of bounds for Verlander yesterday.
That's interesting. A couple of weeks ago on Fangraphs, where a lot of your fine work can be found, you did a preliminary top 30 starting pitcher rankings for next season. And, you know, look, obviously this stuff is going to be in pencil. A lot of things are going to change. We're going to find out about, you know, different injuries are going to come down. Some players will change teams. But even 2 weeks ago, you had interesting. You had Verlander first and Scherzer second. And I guess my first call would be I have nothing wrong with that list. I mean, I think those guys are both justifiable in the first round if you want to go that route. I have a lot of first round Scherzer this year, which was really fun until maybe about a month ago. We'll see how he finishes up the season. But how do we handle age? I mean, normally a pitcher in his mid to late 30s, I'd be like, man, I don't want to be a year late on this. But
yeah,
you're full speed ahead with a couple of guys in their mid 30s. I'm not saying you're wrong, but just talk about maybe some of the ambivalence with a guy when he's at that stage of his career.
No, I absolutely understand the trepidation with it. You know, I repeatedly beat the drum of the ageism in fantasy baseball and with pitchers especially. And I did make a note that Gerrit Cole would be my number one if he resigns with Houston. I'm just not sure that he's going to. And so I did go with the two old guys in Verlander and Scherzer. I understand, you know, wanting to get out before the wheels fall off, but neither of them have shown anything to suggest that the wheels will fall off. Even Scherzer with the rhomboid strain, we all learned what a rhomboid muscle was this year, is impeccable with his stats still. And even the 142 innings that he has now, let's say, you know, he gets another 30 or whatever. So he's still going to have 170. Yeah, it's a far cry from the 220 that he's pretty much been averaging for the last 5 years. But we also know that in today's era, you don't need 200 plus innings to be the top dog at pitcher. So I think even if you're really worried that Scherzer is going to, you know, have this one injury a year and kind of be more of a 180 type of guy, you could still take him at number one and in the first round because they are just so good. Outside of the age, there is literally nothing to suggest that either Scherzer nor Verlander is falling down. And so you can use that age if you want, but I think that's too much of a cop-out to just say, I want to jump off because they're old. Their skills are there. We've been taught, you know, to trust skills, and there's no reason that they should just have a major decline any more than if, you know, Shane Bieber got hurt and ended up missing the year. Like, I don't think there's heightened risk with Verlander and Scherzer as opposed to those younger guys that are just behind them, like DeGrom, Cole, Buehler, Sale, Bieber. That rounded out my top seven there.
Right. Yeah, we're going to get to Bieber in a second. Let me ask you one more question about Verlander. As a long lifetime Tiger fan, Verlander was still a good pitcher when the Tigers traded him to Houston, that famous deal that went down really the last minute a couple of years ago. But then he's really stepped it up into another gear or two with the Astros. Can you explain that? Does that frustrate you as a Tigers fan? You're just happy as a Verlander or a baseball fan? How do we reconcile the fact that Verlander was good at the end of his Detroit career, but now he's in another world right now?
Well, I know there's the speculation about, you know, that Trevor Bauer's thrown out and others about, you know, whatever they use to get the grip. First off, every team's using something. All pitchers are using something to kind of get that extra grip, whether it's the rosin, suntan lotion mix, you know, pine tar, whatever the case may be. It's not just that. It just doesn't work. It doesn't go that well because, again, every team's using it. So, and it's not making everyone pitch like this in their mid 30s. What I think it is really, though, is the analytics department helping Verlander maximize what he has. For me, one of the things that I like to push back on is this notion that, and you didn't suggest this, but too many have, that he had this down period, that Verlander had this, that he was like fading and then rebounded. He had one bad year. It was 2014, and he still went 206 innings. He had a core surgery that March that lingered for the entire year. We couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. And that was the year that I really crystallized that just because you're on the field, you're not 100%. It finally hit home in every conceivable way. And now I understand that fact and carry that with me all year. Just because someone's playing does not mean that they're healthy and 100%. And he gutted out a you know, 206 inning mediocre season. But after that, 2015 was a little bit more of the shoulder issue. But once he got back, Verlander was great again. And it was the high fastball with his off-speed stuff. I think that Houston, with their analytics, has understood how to maximize what his pitches are and help him have the game plan, which is, again, high heaters and breakers down, and just pound that. And that's how you're going to be successful. Get back to the high heater and live it and love it. And I think that that's really helped dial Verlander up and maximize what he's done. I think he'd still be good if he was with Detroit, but it would be kind of this okay version. And listen, we can't quantify it, but there is a difference. There has to be a difference between playing with a winner versus the arguable biggest loser in the league, like the worst team. I mean, we're seeing with Castellanos, he's been vocal about it. It affects guys differently, but I definitely think Verlander is somebody who would never roll over with a last place Tigers team, but certainly charges up a bit when you're playing with the best team in the league, or arguably the best team in the league. And so I think all of those factors together have him maximizing himself and playing as arguably the best pitcher in baseball in his mid-30s.
And as you said earlier, you mentioned that Cole would be your number one pitcher if he resigns with Houston. Just the importance of being with the right team that gets it, that understands the analytics, that can put a good defense behind you, even the pitcher park doesn't hurt. And we saw with Cole, they've reinvented who he is. He threw a different fastball in Pittsburgh. You know, it was about ground balls in Pittsburgh. It's about high fastballs, four-seamers, and getting strikeouts and missing bats in Houston. He's a totally different guy now.
And he maximizes his secondary stuff too, which was always an issue I had with Pittsburgh, and why I was either hoping that they'd somehow change their philosophies in Pittsburgh with Cole or get him out of there. And when he was traded, I pardon the back patting, but I was so in on that. I was so happy to get Cole everywhere. I knew, I just knew that they were going to maximize him and get him back to the pitcher that he was in 2015, perhaps even better. And that's exactly what's happened. Because when you watched Cole, you saw this devastating secondary arsenal that Pittsburgh was stifling because they were forcing him to use 60 to 65% fastball. And not only that, but a lot of two-seamers and sinkers. And he had a good one, but no, you want four-seamers and then more of those breaking pitches, particularly the slider and curve. And he has, he had a changeup that he can flash, but it's really slider and curve with the fastball for Cole. So yeah, I loved when he got there. I think he'll still be good if he goes to another team, but I do worry a little bit. You know, again, I'll put him at four. It's not like I'm tumbling him down my board if he goes to Anaheim, which is the early rumor for Garrett Cole.
We have some dueling dogs going on. I have a dog barking. In my background, I heard your dog a little bit earlier. So maybe the dog days of August are over. Remember, last week was our dog episode with Fred Zinke. But still a lot of bark left to be done in September. And don't go gentle into that good fantasy night. We still got 30, 32, 31, something like that. You know, 4 full weeks plus. That's of right. Baseball, so still a lot of time to get to where you want in the standings. You mentioned Bieber, and what a strange year it's been for that Cleveland pitching staff. Kluber, of course, got hurt. You had Bauer just detonate and then get traded. And we'll talk about Bauer in a second. You know, he's been just a mess in the National League. What a great scene seeing Carlos Carrasco return from leukemia and pitch awesome this weekend against Tampa Bay. And then Bieber's been the standout, really the breakout guy. A lot of people saw this breakout coming, but you're really in on Bieber. Again, these are preliminary ranks. Don't kill Paul if you know one of these rankings looks bad in 8 months. This is more of a fun exercise. Let's just get an idea. You know, we're doing some practice getting ready for next year, but you and Shane Bieber very aggressively ranked. You have him preliminarily, of course, as your number 7 pitcher for next season. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that about how some folks were in on him. And if I'm going to backpat on one, I'm going to go ahead and expose myself on another. Bieber was somebody I had a lot of trepidation about coming into the year, as it was clear that he had a lot more control than command. And he really highlighted the difference between those two last year with that sparkling 5% walk rate, but 10.2 hits, a 1.0 homer 9. And when you watched Bieber, you understood why that happened. And he was kind of the critical example of why I'm always cautious when people use BABIP as a luckometer. And they were saying, you know, his 356 has to come down. It's like, it won't come down without changes. Unless he figures out how to command his stuff and throw better strikes, it's not guaranteed to come down. Now it has, and he has made that development. And I've been really impressed with the development that we've seen from Bieber. He throws a lot better strikes. He does still have a bit of a home run issue, and that's just part of filling up the zone. I mean, listen, if you're not walking anybody and you're not giving up a lot of hits, you can give up homers. The aforementioned Verlander has done it. I mean, he might lead the league in homers allowed and win a Cy Young. So if you're giving up solos, I'm not too worried about it. But he's cut three hits off of his hits per nine, Bieber has, down to 7.3, a very reasonable 7.3. Continue to walk nobody and has a brilliant strikeout rate. I really think that he's come into his own. He has a deep arsenal that he commands. He can command all four pitches. It's actually really 3.5. The changeup's kind of a show me. But I really like everything that Bieber's done. And kind of going against what I said earlier, not so much against it, but the counter to it, I was mentioning how you don't have to have big innings totals to be an uber stud these days. That doesn't mean that you don't want the guy who can go 220. And I think Bieber's going to challenge for some innings pitched crowns here in the near future, perhaps even this year. I don't know how close he's tracking. He has 181 innings right now, and he's going to get a full month left. But I really like that about Bieber, and that even if you don't fully believe in the strikeout rate, which you probably should, but if you have a little consternation about it, fine, peel it back a little bit. But the volume of strikeouts will be there, because I think this is a 200 plus inning guy for the next, you know, 4 or 5 years. We never know with health, but as far as what his ability shows, he should be a 200 inning plus guy every year with quality stuff. So I really like Bieber. I zipped him up my rankings, and I feel very confident about him as at least a top 10. He may move from that 7 perch, as you mentioned, but he's going to stay in my top 10 pretty much guaranteed at this point.
3 complete games and 2 shutouts this year, which I believe are tied or lead the majors, which just shows how much that's changed over the last 20 or 30 or even 10 years, where pitchers don't go deep. I'm actually in a couple of roto leagues that use complete games and shutouts. I'm in a head-to-head league that uses it, and I'm in a roto-style league where shutouts are a category, where if you just get any shutout at all, I think I got a Giolito shutout like 10 days ago. I immediately jumped 6 points in the standings. It's funky. I wouldn't necessarily set up a league by that, like myself, like that, but it's different, it's fun, and it values going deep in the game and having a chance to get that shutout. And of course, you need to be economical to get a shutout now, too, because you can't have – if you have 115 pitches for 7 innings, they're taking you out. So
you're done.
That speaks to Bieber being around the plate. I also love the fact that you mentioned the home runs are not penal. Look, you want our guys around the plate. We want our guys throwing hard. Sometimes the ball's going to get squared up. And if you square up a fastball in the mid to high 90s, it's going out of the park. It's just kind of the price of doing business. I don't think it has to hurt Shane Bieber at all. I like the aggressiveness there. You have Noah Syndergaard at 12. And again, preliminary list. Maybe he won't be on the Mets next year. You're already kind of pining that maybe he'll be an Astro, which I think would make us all pretty interesting. I struggle with Syndergaard. I look at his strikeout rate the last 2 years. It's just about 1 per inning, which used to be good. Now it doesn't really get you started. His ERA this year is over 4, and even his FIP is in the mid-3s. He seems to break down sometimes. I mean, he's going to probably throw 190, 200 innings this year, so that hasn't really been a problem. But I just feel like a little bit like Strasburg, I feel like Syndergaard is the tease more than anything, where we know his upside is Cy Young Award winner, the front man of a staff, but really DeGrom's been their ace. And something doesn't add up for Syndergaard. I admit, and I know this can be a fantasy flaw sometimes, I think I've been burned enough by Syndergaard in the past that I might be leery of drafting him. You have given him the aggressive pre-seasonal ranking of 12. So talk about your feelings about Syndergaard.
I totally understand all of the negatives with Syndergaard. And you know, I hear that when I do podcasts with Nick Pollock, and he and I are pretty disparate on where we stand with Syndergaard.
But your list is terrific, yeah.
Right. Yes, and he's somebody, Syndergaard is somebody I have a hard time quitting. I mean, look, he added 43 points to his ERA with that last start, and I had these rankings out before that. I'll be honest, they probably would have been down a couple spots if those were his numbers when I was looking at it. But I still look at this guy as somebody who, I don't know if it's the right organization or not. It might not. Maybe that's a cop out and lets Syndergaard off the hook. But I still see the ace package here. All the elements needed to be an ace are here. It's just a matter of if he's going to get there. And again, it's not like the Mets haven't developed aces, so I can't even put it on them the way I could very clearly put it on Pittsburgh with Gerrit Cole. I just have a hard time moving away from Syndergaard because he has that talent. And because unless this year, I mean, we'll see how it goes this year. He has to shave off at least the 14 points to get back under 4. And we'll see if he can do even more than that down the stretch. But outside of this year, perhaps he's never been bad either. He's been disappointing. And Strasburg's a great name to invoke, as you have, because he's been disappointing and not quite what we want, Strasburg too. but they've never been bad. They've never been truly detrimental to your team. They've had some injury issues here and there, but you can only hold that against a guy to some degree. But as far as the actual performance that you get, it's never been detrimental to your club outside of where we're at right now with the 4.14 ERA because of that 9 earned run outing from Syndergaard. But I'm going to stick with him. Even if he does meander down a bit, I'm not sure I'm going to get him any lower than, say, 16, 17, because the foundation is still there. And I do believe that we'll have an ace season sooner or later. Obviously, I can't keep betting on it every single year, but we'll see how this one finishes up. And I'm still going to be there for 2020. And I think I'm going to be getting a discount because I think the market is where you and Nick are at. And I'm now kind of a straggler with Syndergaard.
Yeah, I do think the market is going to finally start to give you that coupon. I feel like it never really existed before. Perhaps next year, but it seems like the timing is right. And even Strasburg, he's probably come down a half round to a round in recent years. And you mentioned a great point about Strasburg. You're getting a lot more floor than I think people give him credit for. Yeah, I mean, 1 year he had Tommy John. What can you do? That's just some pitchers are going to have that. You really can't hold it against them. But generally, you get something out of Strasburg. You get somebody who you pitch every week, no doubt. He's in your lineup. Syndergaard's the same way. Certainly the Mets defense hasn't helped him out. Can you just speak maybe to how could the strikeout rate make any sense? He has so much. His stuff is so terrific. He's got multiple pitches. Is it a matter of maybe toying around with too many things? Is you think it's maybe sequencing or his approach? Or
absolutely.
I don't know if maybe the defense is messing with his head. Do you get as frustrated as I do when I just see how is Noah Syndergaard striking out just about a batter per inning? It just seems like he should be so much better than that.
I do believe that there is something with regards to his usage, the sequencing with what he does with his stuff, because it's all there. And even right down to the fact that his swinging strike rates have always been strong. This year is a 4-year low at 13%, but he's basically been living at 14% before that. And generally a shorthand that you can do is take the swinging strike rate, multiply it by 2 to 2.5, and that's a general range for your strikeout rate. Well, in this instance, he is kind of right at that 2.0, but a guy like Syndergaard should be closer to the 2.5 mark. That's where guys like, all the guys that we've named so far, like Verlander, Scherzer, Cole, even DeGrom, they can live there. And Syndergaard has the capability and yet always seems to fall short. And I think one thing that Nick would say if he were here is that he cannot stand when Thor throws thigh-high sliders and fastballs that linger in the middle of the zone. And those are two things that obviously can get crushed, both of them. And obviously the sliders need to be lower and the fastballs need to be higher. And when they are, he's throwing games like the one, I forgot what the name is for it, but when he threw a shutout, Syndergaard did, and hit the home run to make it a 1-0. It was like a perfect win or something like that, that they call it. And when he's on, you really see the excellence that can be Thor. But it is so maddening that he has just 2 double-digit strikeout games with this arsenal. And I do think part of that's on him. Part of that is on coaching. I think somebody should be there to help him understand what he needs to do as well. And I don't know if it's coaching that is being offered and he's not taking it. We never know with stuff like that. But there is, again, still the foundation here to be somebody who averages 10 strikeouts per 9 with 7, 8, 9, 10 double-digit strikeout outings in a given year. He has that capability. It's just a matter of getting there. And so, yes, I agree with the frustration, but that's why I can't quit him, is because it is still there.
Let's stick with the frustrating theme. Again, these ranks are a couple of weeks old. I don't want people to overreact to what they mean. It's more of an exercise, I think, in fun and just kind of try to get some things written down in pencil for next season. Trevor Bauer, when this list came out, was starting pitcher 17. I'm trying to think what went wrong with this guy. I mean, he was having kind of an up and down season with Cleveland. The strikeouts were always there, but the ratios weren't very good. Obviously, his final pitch for Cleveland was much ballyhooed. It was a chuck to center field, a hell of a throw, by the way. I think Angel Hernandez really called it a strike, but traded to the Reds, from the Indians to the Reds. And even though the strikeouts have continued the National League, he's just getting his lunch handed to him. His ERA is 8.40 right now. And even though that's unlucky, the FIP is 4.95. How unlucky could it be? Whip of 1.7. We're talking about 6 starts. But here's the thing. I know Trevor Bauer's talented. I know he's still into an age 29 season, so he should have a lot of juice left. But it feels like when this guy doesn't have it, you get a disaster. Look out below, and there may be a combustible personality there. That can be channeled into a good thing. You want our pitcher. We want our best athletes to be competitive. We want them to believe in themselves and to have kind of that bulldog mentality. But then when it goes wrong, it's easy for hot takers to kind of point at it and be like, oh, man, maybe he's too hot-headed. Where are you at right now on Trevor Bauer?
Fully out. And if I did a re-rank on these, it'll be difficult to convince some folks that it's based on the Cincinnati, that it's not based on the Cincinnati outings, but it's not. This is somebody I've been giving a lot of thinking to. And even as I was ranking him 17th in this list, I was like, are you sure you want to do that? Because I didn't really like him coming into the year. I was a little bit nervous that it's really only been the one great year, and it was a Cy Young caliber type of season. You know, if he doesn't get hit by that comebacker, perhaps he defeats Snell and has an AL Cy Young under his belt. But I worry about his tinkering. He's a bit of an over tinkerer, and you know, start to start, inning to inning, he's always working on things, but when you fix one thing, you can create another issue. And I don't necessarily, I can never sit here and tell you that I thought he'd be a 450 ERA kind of guy this year, but I absolutely thought that he'd be closer to a mid threes with a boatload of strikeouts. So that's going to save his fantasy value. But for me, when we have a guy like this who has just one great year and he's going to be 29, we don't usually pop them up into the top five like this. And that's exactly what we did last year. And he was actually a late first rounder in some late main event leagues. And I just can't do that with Bauer. So everyone, y'all can have him. And I understand that some of you are saying the same thing about Syndergaard. I get that. But for me, I think Bauer's always going to kind of be in the workshop, always tinkering, and it's going to go guardrail to guardrail. And that inconsistency is so frustrating. In Roto, sure, you just need the bottom line. But in head-to-head, it can be even worse because you're getting these awful weeks here that could cost you your game. And sure, you're going to get some weeks where Bauer can single-handedly win it for you, but I just don't want to deal with it. And so on a re-rank here, he's closer to 30 and maybe even outside the top 30. I just don't know that he's any different than really like a Robbie Ray with a little bit better control. And you go look, and what, Robbie Ray had the one great year too, where he was had the sub three ERA, and we didn't really expect him to ever get back to that. Now, one difference between those two names, and I'll be clear on that, Bauer is a much better bet for innings, and innings do play, and that does help. But in terms of just the overall results profile, I'm not sure that they're all that different. And so for me, I'm moving out on Bauer. And again, the next update here, he won't be anywhere near 17.
I know ERA is not a perfect metric, yet we still use it for 5x5. We pay the bills with ERA, even if it's not the best way to evaluate a pitcher. But very telling that only once has Bauer had ERA below 4.19. I mean, we need to be better than that. And his career FIP is 3.90. So you know, maybe there's some luck at play, but maybe he's driving some of that luck too. And you know, I know some people are going to jump on me for this, but there's also just that little bit of knucklehead risk with Bauer that maybe pushes him back a half round to a round for me. And a lot of times with drafts, it's not so much that you're even violently out on somebody. It's just, you know, somebody else is going to want him more than you do. And so you end up never taking him. I just feel like Bauer is going to be one of those players for me next year. One of your fun ranks, and this is a total speculation, we don't know what they're going to do, but Shohei Ohtani, a player I feel like I've been wrong his entire career. When he first came up, I thought, okay, he'll pitch. The hitting's a novelty. I know they promised him some offense when he went to the Angels, but I don't know if it's ever going to account for anything. And it turns out he's a wonderful hitter, an unbelievable athlete, really fast. He's had the arm problems. He's had to be shut down as a pitcher for a while. So he's really just been an offensive player for the Angels this season. You preemptively ranked him in your top 30. And again, it's a fun rank. It's an early rank. You know, we have to take that for what it is. But where do you think the Ohtani story is headed next?
See, I kind of parked him there, acknowledging that he could be amazing for us, right? And one of the things with Ohtani that we need to understand is what the Angels are going to do, but what also the fantasy outlets are going to do. Last year when he was a pitcher, that's the only thing that NFBC gave you. And, you know, certain outlets, Yahoo went one way, CBS went a different way, ESPN went. So hopefully I'd like to see some universality with that. first and foremost with Ohtani, that you can use him as a pitcher or a hitter. Not both. I don't think his hitting should count when he's listed at P on your team, but I do think that you should have the ability to get both if you want. And so if you want to put him in as a hitter because he's only going to get one bad start on the week, but he's going to bat five other times, that's great. I did rank him with the acknowledgement that that he would be more of a dual player, and that's why I've got him at 25. If he is pitcher only, and we learn from the Angels that they're going to probably go for, you know, 150 innings, I think he's still a top 30 guy, though. He'd only move down like five or six ranks. If we know that they're going to do 4 days a week batting, once a week pitching, and most outlets are going to allow you to dual it up, I think I'm going to put him in the top 20. And it's weird because he'll be a top 20 asset as far as SPs go, but not necessarily just because of his pitching. So it's a difficult rank with Ohtani, but the bottom line, Scott, is that I want him on my teams because he's just so good. And I believe that he can be an elite pitcher while giving you some contributions at hitting. If they go completely the other way and make him like a middle guy, a follower, if you will, whatever that, the 2 to 3 innings or 4 innings every time out, I'd actually be okay with that because that would spike his win capability. And I almost think that that would be the better fantasy asset. Less taxing on his arm gives Ohtani more opportunities to hit. And like I said, spikes our ability to get wins from him. But either way, I want in on Ohtani's shares almost regardless of what Anaheim's gonna, or LA is going to do with him next year.
You're listening to the words of Paul Sporer, who's our guest on the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. Catch his work on FanGraphs and, of course, on Twitter at Sporer, S-P-O-R-E-R. No better source to talk about pitching and no better source to talk about Justin Verlander and just fantasy baseball in general. Frankie Montas was in the middle of a breakout year, ERA of 2.70, whip just over 1.12, better than strikeout per inning, comes down with a PED suspension, basically wipes out most of his season. I really never know what to do with guys like this because whatever they took, it's going to be in them for a decent cycle. I'm not a doctor. I'm not somebody who can speak to how those things generally work. I mean, it hasn't hurt Nelson Cruz since he's come back. Yeah. I don't know. How do we handle what goes into trying to project Frankie Montas for next season?
Well, you know, I'm not too worried about whatever it was that he took or him losing the magic or anything. I don't think this is a pumpkin situation where he's not able to take what he tested for. And so he's going to get in trouble or he's going to fall performance wise. Because if you look, the elements were already there with Montas and it was surprising that he got suspended. And it was a bummer for those who had him for those 90 innings. But if you look the previous 2 years before 2018, he had the swing and miss stuff. It was nasty stuff, but he had no idea where it was going, and neither did the opposition. Then last year, he seemed pretty committed to figuring out this control piece. Hey, I've got to throw strikes. This is what, this is how I'm going to do it. And my strikeouts be damned. And he ended up with a 15% rate. This year, he put the whole thing together. And I don't think there's anything in a bottle that he took to do that. I don't think that that's where it comes from. I think that's more of staying healthy and staying on the field and all that, which has value, but I don't think that he's going to lose that capability of being able to strike out guys at a 26% clip, 6% walk rate. That new splitter was massive for Montas. I love everything that he did this year, except getting in trouble. I don't really have big grievances about PEDs. Obviously, if you get caught, you have to face the music, but I don't care that players take them. And I'm not going to run away from this profile at age 27 that was in the midst of a breakout. Because again, there was nothing that he took that created this pitcher. He honed himself and maybe it helped him get in the gym more and all that. I get that. But like you mentioned, that doesn't go away. And so I'm still fully bought in on Frankie Montas, and I will take him as a top 30. I'll be interested to see where the market is. In my first couple mocks, I probably won't take him just to see what my competitors are doing, and then I can decide where I'm going to be. But I'm going to have Montas shares, and I think they're going to be cheaper than they should be because this is a great pitcher here.
I want to talk about somebody who was on your also receiving votes. Again, you were ranking the top 30 pitchers for 2020, sketching them out in pencil in the middle of August. I was in on Matthew Boyd before the season. I know you were too. And the way he pitched early in the year, 13 strikeouts against the Yankees before their team photo went on the injured list. The strikeouts have been there all year. He's got 219 as we sit in 165 innings. So he's bumped up that strikeout rate almost to 12 per nine. But man, a couple of blow-up starts. His ERA is in 4.58 right now, and it's not all that unlucky if his FIP is 4.31. The WHIP is very playable at 1.18. I forget who said first, if the ERA and WHIP don't match up, trust the WHIP. It might have been Todd Zola. It might have been you. It might have been me. I'm not sure exactly who came up with that. I know I say it an awful lot, and I'd like to credit whoever coined that phrase. I don't think it was me. But anyway, Matthew Boyd, I feel both justified, validated, and frustrated by this season. So tell me where you stand with Boyd these days.
Yeah, I definitely was in. My one point of trepidation with Boyd was, be careful of that defense. Well, then he starts striking out the world, and it's like, well, you're not going to be as prone to the poor defense if you don't put the ball in play at all. And obviously, he was having a brilliant season. And now he's just become an absolute home run machine. Like he realistically should pitch the home run derby next year so that we have another exciting one. He's given up 28 home runs in his last 15 starts. Like you said, the strikeouts are still there. That's 122 strikeouts in those 87 innings, which is pretty incredible. And so I think there's still something to really like there. I don't know that the defensive situation in Detroit's going to improve all that much anyway. But again, when you're allowing these kinds of home runs, you can't really blame that on the defense anyway. So I'm not sure how much it's actually ended up hurting him. And despite all these home runs, you still have the strikeouts and a 118 WHIP to kind of fall back on. All in all, and I know the makeup of it is really hurting folks because that, you know, if you're doing great in the first half and kind of hanging on or charging up your standings, now he's bringing you down with every passing start because he does have a 6 ERA since about June 7th for Matthew Boyd. But I think the bottom line is actually still going to look pretty good unless he continues to give up 3 homers per game in these last 4 or 5 starts for him. But I like Boyd. I'm going to be careful with him, and I'm going to have to see what the market does again here, because if he has those believers in certain drafts that they really want to take him in that top 30, I can't do it because I'm not sure that the home runs are just going to go away. Home runs have always been an issue for him, never to this degree, but they've always been kind of prevalent. And he's that example of command versus control that I talked about with Bieber. Right now, he's got some really strong control, but he has brutal command. He throws some of the worst strikes possible. I mentioned those thigh-high sliders with Thor. Boyd loves those. And you know, center-cut fastballs as well, just trying to challenge guys. You got to go higher if you're going to do that. So I think he's more of a 40-ish type of guy, maybe 50. You have to kind of plan for it, though. You can plan and say, hey, maybe like a Mike Soroka is a good cover for somebody like Boyd because their skills and their deficiencies match up really well. I think your ratios are going to be strong with Soroka and your wins, really. Whereas Boyd will give you the strikeouts and his ERA might be a little bit challenged. And so you mix those two together and they look fantastic. So I think if you're planning properly with your roster and not just taking best available, but actually constructing a staff, Boyd fits well on a lot of clubs, but I'm not sure that the ERA is going to be that much in the low fours because I don't think that the home run problem is just going to disappear. So I'm a little bit nervous about him, but you can't ignore the strikeouts. A 219 and 165 innings is absolutely disgusting. And I think it's justified by his base skills.
I love that idea of drafting your roster so it fits with other players on your roster and you're just not making picks in a vacuum. I mean, to some degree, go out and get talent, but there are going to be certain profiles of players that fit with other profiles of players and enable you. If you get a bank of batting average, maybe you can take on the home run guy who hits 217, stuff like that. You know, how you fit stolen bases may fit how you attack them later. Just your roster is interrelated. It's, you know, you have to consider that. And I think that's a really good tip. Also, I will also confess that I spent about 3 weeks before the trade deadline refreshing the internet, just waiting to see that Matthew Boyd was traded to the Astros. I knew that they were scouting him, right? I just thought, okay, this is great. You know, I saw what Verlander and Cole did there, and not that Boyd is on their level. I mean, how many guys are, but this certainly was the landing spot I wanted. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. I still don't think Boyd is going to be on the Tigers all that much longer. So
I hope not. It'd be the right move to get rid of him because he's not going to be part of their next great team. Pitching's the one thing that they have in the minors. So yeah, I think that, but you know, as well as I do, trusting Al Avila to do the right thing isn't a great idea.
No, it really isn't. I want to give a hit to one more piece of content you recently put out at FanGraphs. And again, you know, you want somebody who's prolific. You want somebody who's smart. Paul Sporer checking all those boxes when it comes to fantasy baseball. You did a draft with Vlad Sedler, who's been on this podcast, and Justin Mason, the great man who runs the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational. A lot of love for Justin. The three of you got together and did a preliminary, I guess, like a top 45 for next season. Mm-hmm. We each drafted a handful of teams yourselves. And I know you didn't have the first pick, so I this isn't necessarily that you have to speak for it personally, but Vlad had the first pick in this 2020 mock. He took Acuna over Trout. The top of the board went Acuna, Trout. You had took Yelich, then Bellinger, Story, Lindor, Betts, Cole, Scherzer, and Freeman round out your top 10. And one of my favorite guys, Anthony Rendon, I will mention, went 11th. Where are you at right now about the idea that maybe Mike Trout isn't the first player picked in fantasy next year?
I'm open to it. My jaw did not hit the floor when Vlad made that move. I think it has to do with so much of the speed kind of falling from the game, at least the distribution of it. I think steals are actually down this year, but they're not down as much as we would probably think in terms of overall steals. But this is something Gene McCaffrey's hit on very well when he does his HQ spots with Patrick Davitt, is that the distribution of them is what's really different, and that in that they're spread out a bunch. So if you can get these guys who steal 25 plus, 30 plus, maybe even 40 this year, as Acuna chases down a potential 40-40 season, that's massive. So even if you're not saying that that he's going to match everything that he's done power-wise this year for Acuna going into his age 22 season, the fact that you're probably going to get upwards of 30 plus steals with it is huge, especially as Trout slows down a bit. He has 11 this year. Now, he's only going to be 28. He's been around this long, and he's only going to be 28 next year. And we know that steals can vacillate. I don't want to go so far to say that Trout is done running. He had 11 in 2015. That was 159 games. The next year, he had 30. So that stuff can go up and down, and we've seen it from Trout himself. So that's why I don't think it's a lock to take Acuna and just say, hey, he's going to run more than Trout, book it. But I understand it. For me, I still think I take Trout number one, but I do think that there's a reasonable case to take Acuna and maybe even Yelich. I think those three are a jumbo that you just kind of go and you take your favorite of the group. For me, it's still Trout, though. You don't lose taking Trout. You just don't. I mean, even the season that he really got hurt and only played 114 games, Scott, he still had a 33-22 season. That's disgusting. So even the season where he missed almost 50 games, I still had an amazing performance from him. So I'm just going to open book test when you're drafting first. For me, it's Trout and you book it, but I understand Acuna and even some Yelich shares up at the top.
I will also mention that Xander Bogaerts was not one of the top 25 picks, and maybe I'm falling into recency bias here because he's had a monster second half. You know, the Red Sox may not make the playoffs, but man, the good part of their lineup is obscene. I mean, Mookie's going to score 150 runs. What a year for Devers. Bogaerts and JD, I mean, the top four of that lineup are so good. Of course, they have all sorts of other problems, and maybe they just don't deserve a playoff spot the way they've played, but he's been a fun guy this year. We always have fun with our man Paul Spohr. Again, you know, knowledgeable on anything you want to talk about with baseball, whether it be fantasy or real life. Now we're going to pivot to very much fake life. We're going to talk movies in our fantasy draft, and we're going to talk movies we haven't seen. And as I was assembling this list, I realized the more I'm going to talk about this, the more I'm just going to look like a clown. I'll admit, I love to rewatch movies. I've watched Rounders so many times. I look for my name in the credits. I feel like I was in that movie. Props to Brian Koppelman, David Levine for making such a rewatchable movie. I've seen The Big Chill over and over again. I've seen Broadcast News over and over again. Sideways, Rushmore. And yet there are movies I have. I have gaps in my movie knowledge. There's some movies I have with what Joe Posnanski would call trailer knowledge, where I actually know a lot about what happens in the movie, or I may know some of the punchlines or some of the, you know, the hot topics in the movie. And that's actually kept me from a couple of movies because I already know the hook of the movie. We'll get to some of those movies later. But again, I expect we're going to get ratioed on this one, Paul, and I'm fine with it. You know, we're going to take the hits. We had a blast last time. By the way, check out the last time Paul was on. We drafted our favorite Michigan athletes, and man, that was really a lot of fun. We went long on it, but I thought it was worth it. Today, we're gonna shrug and say, hey, I'm taking the loss on this one. I haven't seen XYZ. Paul Spohr, you're up first in the haven't seen movies draft.
All right, so this is where the story comes in. I was ready. We had talked about maybe doing this, and I told you I've got some doozies. This is going to be great. And I lost my number one pick inadvertently yesterday.
Oh, man.
I was ready, and I've it's kind of clown. Like I, at this point, I've almost worn it as a badge of honor. Like, haha, I haven't seen it. And it's not because like, I think it's like a girl movie or anything negative about the movie. I just never saw it and didn't care to see it.
You're going to say Titanic, aren't you?
When my girlfriend basically made me watch Titanic from start to finish on TV yesterday. I had never seen it. And I'm like, this is a dynamite number one pick. And it started off where, you know, where it's Sunday morning, we're just hanging out. I'm basically kind of snoozing on the couch. I even have my glasses off there. So I'm just kind of relaxing, letting her watch her movie. It's one of her favorites. I put my glasses on and I damn well enjoyed it. I got to be honest, even watching it on TV, you know, watching them on cable with the commercial breaks, I was interested. I understand the appeal. So I lost my number one pick because I was going to say, I told her, I was like, I'm still going to take it. She's like, I will find out who your co-host is and I will tweet him that you're a liar if you take Titanic. So I can't take Titanic. I can take another one that's actually going to devastate folks, though. I've not seen The Godfather. Wow. 1, 2, or 3. And it's something I wear with great shame, but it's also a dynamite number one pick here because it is so shameful. So in lieu of being able to take Titanic, which I can no longer claim because I pretty much saw all but about 15 minutes of it yesterday, Godfather's my number one pick. And it's nothing, again, the thing of it is I didn't really become a big movie fan until the late 90s. And I finished high school. I didn't finish in Michigan. I finished in a city called Harlingen, which is in deep South Texas, about 20 minutes from the border. A smaller town, not podunk, but small, not a whole lot to do. So the movies became kind of our favorite thing. So we would go to the movies a lot, but we went to the movies. I didn't necessarily fill the back catalog. And so you'll notice a theme of that. There are a lot of them are older. There's some current ones, but I've just never gone back and watched it. And I absolutely should. It's something I'm almost certain I'll enjoy, but I have not seen The Godfather and I'm a clown for it.
Fascinating. By the way, I haven't seen Titanic either. I don't think I'm going to draft it, but it's a movie I haven't seen. And it's not like I'm trying to be a hipster or anything. I mean, you know, I'll see, there's plenty of movies I've seen that are, you know, not particularly ambitious. You know, I do like a lot of fine movies. For a long time, I would only watch indie movies, but it was more just because what I enjoyed. It's not, you know, like whatever you like. If you want to watch The Hangover and laugh your head off or Anchorman, go ahead and do it. I have no problem with that. You know, I've watched those movies and enjoyed them too. But, you know, interesting first pick there. I would also argue, and people can say what they want about this, if you had a choice of going back and watching The Sopranos or watching The Godfather trilogy, and I realize it's apples and oranges, David Chase has so much more runtime to work with The Sopranos. I'd rather actually watch The Sopranos, but that's just me. My first pick, I'm going to get killed by this. First of all, Michael Salfino like sacks me for this weekly. I've never seen Jaws. But not only have I not seen Jaws, there are a ton of Steven Spielberg movies I haven't seen. And it's nothing against Spielberg, who, I mean, he's one of the titans of Hollywood. I haven't seen any of the Raiders of the Lost Ark movies. I'm not really a Harrison Ford guy. I haven't seen E.T.
Same, on my list.
Schindler's List. I haven't seen Saving Private Ryan.
I have seen Saving Private Ryan, but E.T., Indiana Jones, Schindler's List, all on my list here. And could be drafted later on.
I'm going to cheat. I'm going to cheat, Paul, because my podcast and I'm just a, you know, I am the New England Patriots of fantasy drafters. Actually, I'm a Patriots fan. I don't think they cheat. But whatever. I cheat in this draft. I'm taking Spielberg movies. I'm We're taking limiting. The loss.
Okay.
The joke that we have with Mike and I is I say that Jaws is on my DVR, and I promise I'm going to get to it. And I am. I am going to get to it. It is on my DVR. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. So that's my first pick.
Maybe I should have taken this one number one, but since it's still on the board, I'm pretty sure you've seen it. Most people have. I've not seen Star Wars.
And, wow. Okay.
I really don't have desire to see that. And again, it's not a negative thing. It's not like, oh, you know, I'm with you. Like what you like. This is not a putting anybody down for liking it. I feel like though, if it doesn't grab you as a kid, are you really as into it? And I never really saw it. I've seen pieces of them as like the substitute teachers in for the day and showing a movie, but never a full one. And so I've just not seen Star Wars, particularly the first three I'm talking about here. I have actually seen, what was it, Episode One, the one with Jar Jar Binks. And the reason I saw that is because my friends in high school were waiting in line for the day. And I asked my dad if I could skip school to wait in line. He said yes. So it was a free day off of school. So I had no idea what was going on, but I did see that one. But I have not seen any of the first three. And I actually wear the Godfather one with greater shame, but I probably get chastised more for the Star Wars.
You know, it's funny about Star Wars that's the whole Star Wars thing is something that I respect, but it just doesn't work for me. I'm not a fantasy guy. I'm not a sci-fi guy. Same. I have no interest in watching the Lord of the Rings movies. I was not in on Game of Thrones. I know these things are done impeccably well by smart people with unbelievable budgets and you know, huge casts and special effects. All these things about it. I will not tell anybody not to enjoy these things if you do. They're just not for me. I have seen Star Wars. I've seen about half of the series, but it's not particularly something I'm really into. And again, I'm not knocking it. If you're into it, and I get what I do for a living. My living, after being a regular sports writer for several years, is now I write a game about a game is what I do for a living. So I'm not, you know, who am I to thumb my nose up at anything? If you like Star Wars, go see it. You know, obviously they've come out with a bunch of movies. They've come out with trilogies. It's just not really my thing. So I get it. Although I have seen Star Wars, I understand why. You know, sometimes you just know something. Look, I've never watched a minute of Game of Thrones. I know generally what it's about, and it's just not something that would particularly interest me. I get why it's so popular, but I also get why it's something I do not consume. The second pick I'm gonna make. This speaks to when you know the hook of a movie. Sometimes when it just seeps out. It's just really hard to go back and watch the movie. And I know the hook of The Usual Suspects. I know the way the movie tilts. And because of that, it's really hard for me to watch it. Now, you know, with all the stuff that's come out with Kevin Spacey, with all the stuff that's come out with Bryan Singer, I just don't know if I want to go down that route. I know you got to separate the art from the artist and everything. But I think I'm just going to go off as somebody who's never seen The Usual Suspects. Again, because I know there's a big hook in that movie. I'm not going to spoil it. Look, you should know it by now. But I should know it.
Yeah.
But haven't seen it, probably not going to see it.
Wow. Yeah. Listen, I understand. And I battle with that sort of stuff of separating art from the artist as well. And, you know, listening to music of a bad person or even, you know, fantasy drafting some of these folks that are arrested for
domestic
abuse. That's
a really tough call, right? And what do you do?
Yeah.
Do you draft Osuna or do you draft, you know, Tyreek Hill or Adrian Peterson? That's a really tough call.
It's not easy. I actually do labor with it. And I understand, you know, I'm not perfect on it because on one point I'll have a stance here, but then, you know, I did keep Tyreek Hill on a keeper league and it was icky, but I still did it. So I don't judge folks on that. I understand the difficulty of it. But I also understand you on The Usual Suspects here. First off, knowing the idea of what goes down in it, but then also that extra factor with Spacey and Singer. So I get it. I really do enjoy that movie. That's one I have seen and I love, but I fully understand your point there. I'm going to move on to, I guess, another sci-fi one to kind of hit home the point about the fact that I don't watch sci-fi movies. I've never seen a single millisecond of a Harry Potter movie. Again, I don't want to rehash everything about the Star Wars thing, although it's a little bit different here because I wasn't a kid when it came out. Neither were a lot of my peers, and they still love it. So maybe it wasn't that same sort of thing, but it didn't grab me right away. And I respect it for what it is. I'm with you on that whole thing with like the Game of Thrones and all that. It's awesome. And I love that people love it the way I love baseball and stuff, but it's just not for me. So I haven't seen an ounce of Harry Potter.
Yeah, neither have I for the same reasons. I think we check in at the same hotel on that one. I'm going to get killed for this one. This is a movie that everybody's seen in quotes. And I can even quote this movie a little bit because it's been quoted to me so many times. I don't know why I haven't seen Fight Club. I just haven't.
Oh,
yeah, I love like Brad Pitt. I love Ed. I think Ed Norton's in that, right? I mean,
those two actors
at the top of their games from everything I can tell, especially Norton. I mean, he's an actor's actor. And, you know, I always talk about how much I love Rounders, you know, American History X. I mean, that guy is unbelievable. I just haven't. I don't know why. I have no good reason here for not having seen Fight Club. I just haven't seen it.
I understand. You just missed some stuff that you feel like you shouldn't have, but you have. Again, that is one I love and have seen. Those two are excellent in it, but I get you. I'll veer away from sci-fi for once here and say, I haven't seen Silence of the Lambs, but I know so much about it. This is another one where you pick up so much stuff. As somebody who is interested in movies and you know watches documentaries on them and stuff, I pretty much know everything about it, but I've never seen the movie. So Silence of the Lambs, I don't know that I'm ever going to go back to it. I understand like Clarice references and, you know, a lot of different things that happen in it, but I've never seen the movie and I probably won't.
It's a creepy movie. I saw that in the theater, actually. I remember seeing it and it's weird how you can see a movie and totally respect it, but not really enjoy it. That's where I'm at with Silence of the Lambs. And I get why people like it. I get why people appreciate it. I get how much intelligence and thought and depth went into the movie. It's just not something I particularly enjoyed. And also, there can be movies like – I think of a movie like Leaving Las Vegas. It's unbelievably done and detailed and nuanced, but yet depressing as hell. You know, a lot of times Leaving Las Vegas will be on, you know, cable, or, you know, it's on as a rewatch, and I'm like, do I really have the emotional reservoir to handle Leaving Las Vegas right now? I don't know if I do, because the movie is just really difficult. But yeah, I can understand it with Silence of the Lambs, a movie I respect a lot more than I like. Not saying anything bad about it. It's just, you know, some things are easier entertainment than others. Sometimes you need a popcorn movie. Sometimes you need an Ocean's 11 and just have some fun and not think too much about it. The fourth movie on my list, I don't know why I haven't seen The Graduate. I love Simon and Garfunkel. I love Dustin Hoffman.
You took one of my picks.
I just haven't seen it. I don't know why. Yep. There's a lot of good movies. I mean, look, we were born when we were born. You know, that's a movie that came out before I was born. And there's a list of movies I've been going back and seeing. And I've gotten to some of them. I haven't gotten to some other ones. You know, if you went on the classical list of the 30 greatest movies of all time, I could check off most of them. I just haven't gotten to The Graduate yet. I think that's more of a fluke than anything else. Although I have had people tell me that I might be a little bit disappointed by it. And that's, you know, thing of life, right? You have to try to manage your expectations. I try to go in cold. I do know what the general story is. I don't know. I have no good excuse here. I just haven't seen it yet. But I think the next time I do a draft like this of movies I haven't seen, I think The Graduate will no longer be eligible.
Yeah, I think that's another one where I know so much about it. I know so many references to it, but I've actually never seen it. And that's one that, you know, my girlfriend is actually a decent bit younger than me, and yet she's seen some of those. And so, you know, she makes so many jokes about how I'm old, and then marvels at the fact that I haven't seen some of these movies that that the older person of the relationship should probably have seen. And that's one that she gives me a lot of hell about. And maybe we should both commit to taking that off of our have not seen
list. Yeah, we should. Then we can compare notes at Tout Wars in the spring.
Exactly. All right. So for my last one, I could go with a classic or stick in the sci-fi realm here. I think I'll eschew the Men in Black, because that just gets to the same thing as the Star Wars and the Harry Potter. I'm just not a huge sci-fi guy, and I think I've kind of made that point clear. One of the ones that maybe won't stun a lot of folks, but I'm more bummed at myself that I haven't seen it, is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And you mentioned something about how much you love Rounders, which is something that, you know, even if we didn't agree on much else, we would always have that, because we both adore that movie. And I was going to ask you if you've ever listened to the Rewatchables podcast of that.
I have.
Are you familiar with that? Okay. So they just came out yesterday, in fact, with the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid one. And I love listening to that podcast, but I'm not going to listen to one for a movie I haven't seen that I kind of want to see. And yet, maybe this will finally be the impetus for me to get Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid on the screen and watch it. But at this very moment, I have not seen it. And it's always been one that I wish I'd seen. Not as popular as some of the other ones that I've drafted, but in terms of the movies I like, I think it's definitely kind of up there. In fact, it's even referenced in Rounders, along with The Outlaw Josie Wales. And so maybe I should get that one done, but I have not seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah, always doubles back for Frank Clint Eastwood. Obviously, you get Redford and Hoffman at the top of their games. And Redford and Newman at the top of their games. And you can't go better than that. And I agree with you, you know, on two things that you touched on. Once I want to see something, I try to shut myself off from being exposed to it. I mean, that's more of a case with new movies, where once I know I'm in on a new movie, it's just, okay, I'm not going to read reviews, which a lot of times I think reviews are almost meant to be read after a film a lot of times. You know, why do trailers give away so much knowledge? If I want to see a movie, I isolate myself. And you also mentioned, you know, wanting to be in on understanding that podcast and the Rewatchable Pod, which is very, very re-listenable. I enjoy a lot of their content, especially if I care a lot about the movie. The Rounders one was great. The Good Will Hunting one was great. I mean, most of them are really good. But yeah, I first got into watching the series Mad Men because somebody put one of Molly Lambert's Mad Men recaps on Twitter. And I was like, always thinking, oh, I think I'd like Mad Men. I haven't made time for it yet. and somebody linked to a Molly Lambert recap of an episode. I read it and I'm like, oh my God, this recap is so unbelievable. I want to watch this show so I can get the recap because it's so great. If you're into Mad Men at all, if you're rewatching the series, after every episode, go see if Molly Lambert has recapped that episode. She recapped, I think, the whole second half of the series, and she may have even picked up like around season 2 or 3, but she hit her stride in the middle of the series and was unbelievable through the end of it, to the point that I will say definitively, unequivocally, this may sound like a weird thing to say, like who thinks about these things? My favorite thing that I've read over the last 10 years was Molly Lambert's series on Mad Men. It's unbelievable. I can't say enough how great that is. But it's fascinating sometimes that something related to a movie or a piece of art or some work of art that you want to consume can actually lead you to want to get in on it. Like you're in a club, you're in on something special, and you need to be able to be up to speed to appreciate it as much as you can. For my fifth pick, and I know this theme's been documented a little bit, I'm going to pick The Sixth Sense. He's not my favorite director, M. Night Shyamalan, however you say his name. But that's just a movie that once you know what the hook of it is, I don't know how you watch it. You know, I
agree.
I wish I could have seen it without knowing what you know. But unfortunately, I know it, and I think that colors the whole movie. Plus, he's just based on his style and some of the liberties he takes in certain things, I'm not sure I'd enjoy it anyway. So I don't really feel even any shame or sheepishness saying this. It's just most people have seen The Sixth Sense. I haven't. And I have a feeling I'm not going to get around to that one.
I fully understand that. And, you know, obviously he's had his ups and downs. I'm not Shyamalan has. That was a really good movie. And when you don't know the hook, it's fantastic. But I fully understand that it's tainted for you. And I don't really know. You'd only be watching it for posterity just to check it off, really. You wouldn't, I don't think you'd derive much enjoyment from it just waiting for the shoe to drop there. So I think you should leave that on your list of haven't seens. It's not necessarily 2 hours that you need to spend. Rewatch Rounders again instead. But yeah,
I've never regretted rewatching Rounders or rewatching ever. The Big Chill or Broadcast News, another movie they did a rewatchables pod on. I love that movie so much. Man, I take so much ownership in that film. I think it's grossly underrated. I think it was nominated for Best Picture. It wasn't like people didn't like it, but I don't think historically people give Broadcast News the credit for just how smart it is, how ahead of its time it is. You have three actors at the top of their games. If anybody ever wants to talk about Broadcast News, you can just ping me at any time of day and I'll jump into that conversation because it's one of my absolute favorites.
I totally agree, by the way. And that's something I came to a little bit late. I've only seen it within the last, I'd say, 2 years or so. Fantastic movie, though. And I definitely agree with you there. It hasn't, I don't want to say it hasn't held up because it does hold up. It hasn't been given, it doesn't hold the esteem with enough people. So yeah, count me as a double recommendation there for Broadcast News for folks who want to watch some of these movies that we've been talking about here today. But I agree with you on that Sixth Sense. Once you haven't seen it, pretty much everyone knows, pass on it.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it's the key hook of the movie. Well, okay, that's a wrap on our movie draft. So you can go ratio us on Twitter. Spore is Paul's Twitter account. I'm Scott_Pianowski. Paul, give everybody an idea what you're doing for the rest of the baseball season and how they can hang out with you.
So we'll be balancing, keeping you prepared for your push, your final stretch run in your roto leagues and your playoffs and your head to head while also looking forward. It's kind of that delicate balance there because I know not everybody is in a playoff hunt or a championship stretch drive, but I want to give them what they need, which is a lot of it's going to be, every day doing the starters for tomorrow on who you should consider to potentially pick up and start and stuff like that. And turning over every rock on every team to make sure that you're getting the right players who could come in those September call-ups. Yeah, we love the Gavin Luxes of the world, but it's going to be some of those random guys that are going to turn some leagues. So we want to keep you abreast of that. That's going to be my writing, Jeff Zimmerman, Mike Podhorzer, et cetera, et cetera. Also, the podcast will be going. You can listen to The Sleeper in the Bus on iTunes, Spotify, anywhere else that has podcasts. Spore on Twitter, Spore on Twitch, where I stream out will be the show, and we're always talking baseball. We'll be doing a lot of playoff stuff in October as well. But yeah, as long as you're on Twitter with me at Spore, you're pretty much keeping up with what I've got going on.
Good stuff, man, and an invaluable resource for the people out there who are contending. I mean, I always say you should play the season out anyway, but if you're contending, of course, you're going to be glued in. And man, this is really an awesome time to get an edge on your league. As people start migrating, they go back to school, they get into a fall routine. Obviously, fantasy football is a behemoth. And please listen to Matt Harmon and Liz Loza on the excellent fantasy football, Yahoo Fantasy Football podcast. They have just been crushing it all season. If you still have a draft, you want to check those guys out before you step into it and during the season, of course, as well. But man, I always feel like September is the silly season for fantasy baseball. You know, the rosters expand one last time. We're going to get the mass expansion. You know, some teams are going to start shutting guys down. But this is where our titles are won. This is where the Yahoo shower is finally cemented. So you know, I really feel like if you put the time in, it more often than not will reward you in some way.
I completely agree. Stay diligent. Even those of you who are like 15 points out in your roto league, a lot of times the standings still have those 15 points available. Don't forget, people ahead of you can come back to you. Do not quit. There's plenty of time left to make make hay here and win your leagues.
Well said. Well said. I knew Paul Spora was great the first episode. I expected the second episode to be great as well. I think we've hit that lofty ambition for Paul Spora, for our intrepid director, producer, and all-around man about town, Brett Rader. I'm Scott Pianowski. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another great guest. I don't know who he is, but I will insist he be as great as Paul Spora if we can find somebody like that. Until then, go pound the waiver wire. Go watch some of these movies. I will talk to you soon.